Greetings, Radioland. Last time on the adventures of Ross Douthat, Boy Detective, we left our intrepid hero and his sidekick, Jamie, on the yacht of old sea captain Bill Buckley, searching for the lost virtue gemstones.
Golly, Mr. Buckley, you really say that by taking our clothes off, we're going to be able to skin dive down and find the virtue stones that'll bring bourgeois values of thrift and diligence back to the white middle class?
Why, that's exactly it, my dear boy Ross. In fact, the taxonomy between heterosexuality and homosexuality in the classical context is simply blurred. So why don't you slip those pants off?
Oh, jeez, Mr. Buckley. It feels a little funny, but if it'll help make America virtuous again, by gum, I'll do it.
That's the spirit.
Will Boy Detective Ross Douthat find the virtue stones? Will he disrobe in front of ancient sex vampire and sea captain Bill Buckley?
Yes.
Tune in next week, Radio Explorers, for the adventures of Ross Douthat, Boy Detective. It's Chapo, everybody. It's Chapo. We're back again. That little preview for you was a little taste of things to come, because we are back this week for the triumphant return of Brendan James, a.k.a. Deep Beige, a.k.a. our guest on episode 3, a.k.a. our producer of the show, who's back again to talk Ross Douthat.
Howdy, fellas.
It's good to be back. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good. It's been too long.
Well, you've been our producer basically since episode 3, when you guested and volunteered to like edit it together for us with all the audio you provided.
Yeah.
And you stuck with us, and now you're back, able to come out from behind the curtain for the first time.
That's right. I saw, you know, you guys were like a lump of coal, and I saw, you know, I thought if I could shape it, just maybe there might be a diamond in there, you know.
I am reminded of what Colonel Troutman said to Rambo in Rambo 3, where he goes, "Rambo, I didn't create you. You were always the sculpture within the marble, and I just chiseled you down to be Rambo."
For true fans of the show, you will remember episode 3. We had probably our greatest, our first and I think greatest Chapo reading series, which was Ross Douthat and Bill Buckley on the skinny dipping sailboat trip. But we are going to continue that wonderful tradition now with more readings from the very source material that this was drawn from. The college life and times of young Ross Gregory Douthat, Boy Detective. So what do you think? Should we start the show?
Let's do it, baby.
Lock and load, Jack.
We're on our way now, ducky, ducky. Okay, we are back. It's episode 30. It is me, Will Meneker, and I'm joined by, as always, Felix Biederman.
Hello, everybody.
Matt Christman.
Hi, folks.
And special guest, not even a guest, special co-host, Deep Beige, a.k.a. Brendan James. Brendan, what's up?
Hey, everybody.
Glad to have you here, finally. Like, as we said, pull back the curtain to join us now on the mic.
Some of the best rappers, they were actually producers before they became rappers themselves, and then they just, you know, their fame exploded in ways they never imagined after they actually, you know, stepped out from behind the booth.
Hey, so I'm hoping that happens. Kanye.
All I gotta say exactly. Is if young Brendan don't trust you, I'ma shoot you.
What Brendan is doing, he is taking a path similar to, you know, the men who saved rap. I'm talking about MC Chris, Captain Dan, Macklemore. They started out just sort of as the hand that guided the music, and now he's about to jump on the mic and tell us that he thought he was gay in the third grade because he cleaned his room.
Well, I guess if I think you guys are three Macklemores and I'm Ryan Lewis.
Absolutely, yeah, that's what I see in my dreams. It's what I see when I close my eyes.
Brendan James made it. As I mentioned, this is a return to form. This is a return to the Book of Ross, to our boy, Freeway Rick Ross Douthat. But before we do that, there's some, news to discuss. There's news that's going on in the world, and news about us, most importantly. And I think we should start the show with the triumphant return of Chapo Press Clips.
Chapo Press Clips.
You guys about that? Because honestly, I think in the last week, we've had our best press clip yet. I'm talking about the feature profile of us in Paste Magazine. I hope you guys have seen that. If you haven't, now will be the time to check that out. We'll link to it. But shout out to Jason Rode of Paste Magazine. They asked us great questions. They were fans of the show, and it was super fun doing the interview. And also, in addition to the excellent questions and feature itself, I feel like we should give a shout out to a listener of the show and A-level Grey Wolf, Shannon Strucci, who did the wonderful illustration of us that was featured in the Paste Magazine article.
Yeah, when I saw that, it was like, we made it, fam. We got fan art. And you know what that means next? Deviant art.
Yes.
Hell yeah.
So yeah, once again, shout out to Paste Magazine for the excellent feature on all of us. But also, in the Chapo Press Clips this week, it turns out, thanks to you guys, the listeners, that we are now in the top 30 Patreon accounts like in existence. We are in the top 30 of all the Patreon accounts that exist. And we are sandwiched in between right now someone who makes erotic video games and a podcast about Canada called Canada Land. Now, I have it on good authority from someone who is in Canada that the Canada Land podcast is actually one of the better known podcasts in the nation of Canada. And the Patreon to support it was quite well publicized. So, to you, Chapo Nation, to Grey Wolf Nation, in terms of podcasts, you are now as powerful as the nation of Canada, which is a country of about, 40, 50 million people? So yeah, that's the that's our press clips for this week, and obviously there will be more to come as our power and influence grows. But in terms of the news of the week that I know you all turn to us for, I want to start with a quick story. It began the week, and in my opinion, it was sort of a pall, a black cloud that was cast over this entire week. On Monday, we got word that Rich and Sarah Piana announced their separation. Felix, would you like to comment on this?
Yes. I mean, I wouldn't like to, but this is sort of my Cronkite JFK moment. This was posted on Rich Piana's Instagram from One Day You May. I believe the time has come to announce that Sarah Piana and I are no longer together. It was a crazy, wonderful hashtag living the dream more than anyone could imagine year together. A fairy tale life, but we do have our differences, as all couples do. And we both decided that together, that this was the best scenario. We are still friends and both agree this is the best choice for us. I felt it necessary to announce this on social media because we are no longer, we were together 24/7. So as anyone sees us not together, the first question is, where's Sarah? About 20 people asked me that very question today at the gym. When I say we're no longer together, it's a 20-minute conversation. Whatever happens in life, you have to be strong and keep pushing forward, and Sarah is a very strong girl, and we will both keep pushing forward and being the best we can be in every aspect of life. Hashtag no more queen. Hashtag life must goon. Hashtag, hashtag nothing lasts forever. Hashtag no love like dog love. Hashtag keep moving forward. Hashtag living the dream. Hashtag for life. Hashtag 5%ers mentality. Hashtag dead red. Hashtag best scenario.
Well, I was going to say, Felix, this is very poignant because I feel like it was only last week in Philadelphia when you were watching, Rich give a tour of his house, and Sarah was right by his side when he was like,
you know, I said I would never fucking walk on cold floors again, and now I have this lush carpeting everywhere in my house, in the kitchen, in the bathroom, and it's fucking awesome.
And Sarah was just right there by his side, and there was no clue at all that there was any trouble in paradise. Indeed, it was paradise, but it's, I mean, it's a slap in the face that this happened.
Sarah seems pretty devastated. You know, listeners of the show will know that Icelandic people have a flat affect because of high concentration of mercury in the polar ice caps. But she seems devastated, but Rich is, you know, like he says, life must goon.
Well, let this be a lesson to all the listeners. You know, if you have someone and you love someone, you know, cherish it, because you never know when it'll be gone. Also in this week's news, I feel we should address in our last show with Bro Pair, Dan O'Sullivan, and then again in our show about the DNC, I know I made mention of the fact that I was secretly or not so secretly starting to worry that Trump could possibly win the election based on what I saw at the DNC. That was a bungle, because all the news this week just shows that he's definitely not. And it's a fucking shit show at the in the Trump campaign right
now.
Yeah,
but that you got to unskew those polls, dude.
You have to uncuck the polls. You have to uncuck those polls.
Yeah. I probably should have told you guys this before we started recording, but I did sign a contract that bets the next year of Patreon payments on Trump winning.
Unpredicted.
Oh, but I got good odds.
By the way, who has the siren in the background right now?
I do. I can't do anything about it. I'm sorry.
Yes, you can. You could go out in your community and tell those kids to pull up their pants, and there's going to be no more crime, and there will be no more sirens on your recording.
Also, learn to code, kids. Come on.
Yeah.
Get it together.
It's so bad that... For Trump this week.
The number one among Trump Twitter, they're putting their eggs not just in the uncucked polls basket, but their real hope is that Hillary is suffering from a debilitating brain injury that is going to leave her unable to serve in office. That's what they're
talking about. That was Karl Rove, right? Like a couple years ago or whatever. He's the one who started that rumor.
In 2012, because she had that, like, she like hit her head or something right after the Benghazi thing happened. But now it's back because there are a couple of like edited videos of her looking kind of like she's spazzing out. She does like sort of this comical double take to this reporter, and they cut like 2 seconds of that, and they're like, look, she's stroking out, everybody. So that's where they are. That's the basket that they've got their eggs in. So things are going well over there.
It's always dangerous to judge these things by the reactions we see online, but to be quite honest, online is the only place I interact with diehard Trump supporters, and quite frankly, it's the only place I want to interact with them.
Yeah.
But, they really think that it's a done deal, that he's basically been elected president already, and they're just counting down the days until when they can, like, you know, make America great again. But holy shit. Are they going to be let down? And here's the scary thing. Like, to me, the most disturbing thing that happened this week was Trump operative and con man Roger Stone, who I know we've discussed before on the show, was already laying the groundwork to, like, invalidate the election by planting the seed in the minds of the Trump true believers that the election is going to be stolen from them.
Yeah.
Because he's like, the polls in Florida say that we're up by 5 points today, and if after the Democratic convention it shows that we're down by 2 points, then we'll know the election was stolen. And it's like,
the forces that Stone is trying to unleash are pretty scary. The idea of rendering a presidency illegitimate and actively trying to foment street violence in opposition to an election. But having been amongst the Trump supporters in Cleveland, I just don't think they have the cardio, frankly. I mean, they're just not a healthy bunch. They're beefy. They're older. I got to tell you, if they take to the streets, I think the knees are going to start acting up, you know, and there's not that many charging ports for jazzy scooters in most major metropolitan areas. So
it's like how in Dawn of the Dead or zombie movies, there's always one kind of fat zombie, but it's just all fat. Like, they're only fat ones that would be on the streets.
While my co-hosts are choosing to make light of a situation, I am choosing to make everybody better. If you are either a Trump supporter waiting to take violence into the streets after your inevitable victory, a thousand years of blood, and repellence of the Turk from the Danube River is not met, or you're a Hillary supporter waiting to confront these forces by telling them exactly how bad they look, I will train you how to fight, how to lift, and how to live for only $3,000 a month. $6,000 for your family.
I think Glenn Beck was selling a self-defense series. We got to get in on this racket, man. We really do.
What the fuck is Glenn Beck's self-defense series? You just, like, cry? You play dead?
Things are not looking great for Trump, and basically everyone is now going on this, I think, somewhat ridiculous. We've established that he is a fascist on the show, but what annoys me about a lot of the way it's talked about, I guess, in the mainstream press is that he represents, like, he's so fundamentally indecent or something like that. And which brings me to, Brendan, the article that you wrote this week in Slate, in Slate about, like, the thing that happened this week is, like, okay, in response to the Khan family speaking at the Democratic National Convention, speaking out on behalf of their son, who was, a veteran. I mean, he was killed in the war in Iraq, and they were speaking out sort of against Trump's demagoguery of against American Muslims, etc. There started to be a sort of like idea that was burbling up that, you know, George W. Bush would have never done this. You know, right. George W. Bush never demonized Muslims, or he would, and then it specifically brought up Cindy Sheehan, and they said George Bush, you know, even though Cindy Sheehan was attacking him, you know, he never uttered a bad word against him, and he was always respectful of her.
Yeah,
which was it's strictly on in terms of the words that came out of George W. Bush's mouth is true, but it's absolute bullshit in any context whatsoever. So, yeah. Brendan, you wrote an article that I thought was a much needed corrective to this bullshit. Do you want to tell us about it a little bit?
Well, like you point out, there was this meme that cropped up very shortly after Trump started going after the Khan family. And it went something like, here's this press conference in 2005 when George Bush told Cindy Sheehan that she was entitled to her opinion. Now, Cindy Sheehan was a bereaved mother who lost her son Casey in Iraq in 2004, and she became one of the more popular anti-war protesters in the years to follow. And not only did she get completely smeared by the conservative media, led by Karl Rove, who called her a clown, but she also was courted by the Democrats as a sort of poster woman to get them elected in 2006 during the midterm elections as the anti-war noble opposition. And really the second half of the piece, after going through all the different smears that were thrown at her from the sort of conservative administration complex, because we know from reporting at the Washington Post that the administration was constantly talking about Cindy Sheehan. The second part of the piece was about how the Democrats, much like how they've utilized the Khan's story, now utilized Cindy Sheehan's story, despite having voted for the war that she felt got her son killed. And really the true crux of the piece that I didn't anticipate was listening to her and interviewing her talk about what it was like to be betrayed by the Democrats, because she said, they made me a promise. If you help us win back the House, we will help you end the war. And they went on to fund that war to the tune of billions of dollars.
Well, what I think is so rotten about it is especially, she has a line at the end of your piece where she says, I'm paraphrasing, but she essentially says, like, she hears from a lot of Democrats and liberals who are, like, gleeful that, like, look at all these conservatives that are lining up to support Hillary. Like, they know how evil Trump is or whatever. And her point about that is, like, why doesn't that shame you? Yeah. That all of these people, many of whom were some of the Iraq War's biggest boosters, are, like, Robert Kagan, Max Boot, a lot of these really diehard Iraq hawks, are now openly supporting Hillary. And it's just like, if you're a Democrat or a liberal, why are you proud of that?
And I think that there's an answer to that, of course. You know, I think we've talked about it on the show that the Democrats, perhaps wisely, perhaps a little too smugly, are painting this election as an apocalyptic one in which, look, let's put all of our differences aside on the estate tax and, you know, who said what in the George Bush administration. We all can agree, all rational people can agree, Democrat or Republican, that Trump is an anomaly and needs to be crushed no matter your party. And it's the whole country first thing. That's what Hank Paulson wrote in an op-ed for the Washington Post a couple months ago when he formally endorsed Hillary, was, I have to put my country first. And so they're not ashamed because they're, well, they're not openly ashamed because this is, in fact, the exact strategy they're hoping to wage against the Trump campaign. And it may be a smart one. I don't really know. But it certainly doesn't resonate that well for people like Cindy Sheehan.
And it doesn't resonate well for the prospect of midterm elections, which would be needed to pass any of the agendas that Hillary supporters claim make her the same as Bernie Sanders.
Right.
The running from this center right position, governing from this center right position, building the center right coalition will not take back the House and Senate. But I don't really think they give a shit about that. All their financial backers for the Democratic Party, you can really take care of them through contracts issued through the executive branch. And you tell me if a Republican Congress is going to say no to weapon sales or financial deregulation or whatever. But
we're just keeping things the same, basically.
Exactly. It's all very disheartening for people who actually remembered the Bush years, and it sort of shows the victory of optics over outcomes.
Yeah.
And like the last thing I'll say about this is, like, to call Trump a fascist, like, don't be fooled. It doesn't mean that fucking, like, Paul Ryan or Ted Cruz or any of these other supposedly respectable people aren't fascists. It's just their brand of fascism is folksy.
Right.
And, like, that's what we're used to. Like, they want to get a lump in their throat and say, aw shucks, as they, like, put their hand over their heart and look at a flag or a detention center or something like that. Whereas Trump is just a New York asshole who just likes being a jerk to people, basically.
The other day, I was doing, as I love to do, I was reading the Baseball Crank's timeline. And
our old buddy, the B-Ball Crank, shout out.
This is a huge reunion show.
Yeah,
it really is. But he says, he quotes something about Angela Merkel, and he goes, no, this is my voice for Baseball Crank, just because he's like a cartoon baseball. And it's the same voice as the billiards fool on the Dig cast. But now it seems like Germans who just love Germany are being deemed as racist. And like this is that ideology. It's this, he's just as racist as Trump. He's like, he's saying the, you know, let's repel the Turk from the Danube. They lust for it in their heart. But because Trump is gauche, because Trump is all these things, he takes all the veneer out of what these people say all the time.
Well, that's so perfect you said that, because you know who else had a tweet storm about preserving the racial purity of Germania?
Yes.
And was also a notable Trump critic. Our boy Ross Douthat.
Bruh, bruh, bruh. Wagwan.
Ross Douthat. Real hip hop.
Oh, that's a fucking hell of a transition. Okay. Let's get into the main event for this, the Chapo reunion tour here. Okay. As I mentioned in the cold open, when we first assembled, we did it to do the reading series about Ross Douthat, Chunky Reese Witherspoon, and Skinny Dipping with William F. Buckley. That reading series was drawn from a book entitled Privilege, Harvard and the Education of the Ruling Class by Ross Gregory Douthat. This was published in 2006. This was sort of Ross before New York Times. No, it was actually copyright 2005. So this is before he was at The Atlantic. This is when he was a young up-and-comer, and as such was a little bit less self-aware, and as such a little bit more relatable, maybe a little bit even more likable. But Brendan James, smash that motherfucking like button. Real podcast producer hours. Went to the New York Public Library yesterday and took out a copy of Privilege by Ross Gregory Douthat. He handed it off to me. And now, for you, the Chapo listener, we are going to do the ultimate Chapo reading series. I have skimmed this entire book, and we are going to take you on a journey right now through it. So, just for context, I know we mentioned this on episode 3, but Privilege is Ross's memoir of his time at Harvard. And it is essentially his kind of critique of elite university culture and what he describes as kind of the culture of privilege that permeates among the ruling class. I'm reading from the back now. It says, in the spirit of David Brooks's Bobos in Paradise, a penetrating critique of elite universities. If that doesn't sell you on this book, I don't know what will. Okay.
Finger looking good.
Further context for this book is that I'm reading from the prologue now. He says, I thought at the time, and still think now, that Harvard is a terrible mess of a place, an incubator for an American ruling class that is smug, stratified, self-congratulatory, and intellectually adrift. Now, at face value, I asked myself, and maybe you are as well, from Ross Douthat's perspective, isn't a sort of like incestuous, privileged, elite ruling class like exactly the end result of what good conservative sound politics should be about? But no, I bring to mind, if you've read your Corey Robin, this will not be a surprise to you. Corey Robin's book, The Reactionary Mind, is an excellent heuristic through which to view Ross's dissatisfaction with the elite rich assholes he went to college with. Because as Corey Robin describes it, conservatism is not about preserving tradition. It is about essentially a revolutionary movement that is about creating ever new regimes of privilege and domination to overthrow the old ones because they are insufficiently, they're just not what they really want. The ruling class of America is just not pushing the pleasure centers and the conservative mind. They need to be overthrown, and Ross will tell you why. Okay, you guys ready?
Yeah, I was born ready, Nick. Let's go, man.
Dirk Diggler demo. Keep the
vocals up.
I'm going to start again with the prologue because it gives you some, I think we need some backstory, the Ross Douthat origin story. He describes a lot about how he's always had this fantasy of going to Harvard. Christ knows why. But he talks
because
about his family.
Fucking he took says, a briefcase to class in junior high.
Yeah. Because he had a roller backpack filled with Opus Dei manuals.
So he talks a little about his family background. He says, my father was a Stanford graduate, and his mother had been part of the first class of women at Yale. And he said they but they dropped off the Ivy League track fast in the late 1970s. They bounced around Berkeley for several years and then migrated east with their newborn son, landing in the southern Connecticut half by accident. They had both hoped to be writers during these early years of marriage, but then my mother was chronically ill with strange and inexplicable allergies by the time I was born. And he said, my father, who had drifted through law school before meeting her, took the Connecticut bar and began to practice law, which he continues to do successfully and unhappily to the present day. So he says,
Ross starting out by establishing his parents as losers.
Yeah. He says,
classic rhetorical trick.
He says, so we became superficially bourgeois, taking the form of 1,000 similar families. An attorney father, a stay-at-home mother, 2 kids. My sister Janine was born when I was 9, and a pair of sturdy Volvos in the driveway. The reality was somewhat different, as my mother's ailments, impervious to conventional medicine, drove us to seek unorthodox cures. We drifted through various diets, first vegetarianism, and then a super vegan philosophy known as macrobiotics, and alternate medicines such as homeopathy and acupuncture. My sister was a home birth, delivered by 2 lesbian midwives and breastfed until she was 2. Neither of us were given the usual round of vaccinations, since my mother was convinced, rightly I tend to think, that their side effects were worse than the faint risk of whooping cough.
Comments?
Well, if no one else is going to say it, I will. A lot going on there.
So basically, he was raised by Jill Stein. Is that what happened?
Yeah.
Yes, he was raised by Jill Stein. Ross's mother was a chiropractor, like Jill Stein. The reader can infer several things here. One can be that Ross was, in many senses, a pestilence upon his family from the time he was conceived. Omen.
And then Ross showed up, and all of a sudden the pall fell over the family.
His
parents are happy, then Ross is born, and then his mother came down with all these sympathetic ailments, like rashes, headaches, migraines, just like this that are just low, inexplicable.
Just like this low note on a synthesizer starts, and it's like, shit's getting
like
real.
He had this radioactive radio signature that just like destroyed her brain, like it gave her just piercing headaches to be in the same room with him.
Ross, when Ross was five, he wandered into his parents' bedroom and his head turned around 360 degrees, and he said, "How can we expect women to perform as mothers if they can be mothers whenever they want?"
There was a nanny, and like their family was having a big picnic, and then they all looked up, and the nanny was on the balcony. She said, "This is for you, Ross. This is for you." And then she hung herself in front of everybody.
It's all for you.
It says, "We were religious wanderers too, in the strange and ecstatic world of American Pentecostalism, before we finally came to rest late in my adolescence in the arms of the Roman Catholic Church. But superficially, as I said, we were normal." But of course, like all American families, under that veneer of normality is just a fucking Marianas Trench of fucking pathology and fucking resentment. But throughout all this, Harvard, and the beacon of hope that represented to his teenage mind was ever present. It was his North Star. And his dream was to go to Harvard and be in that world of that exciting world of ideas. And lo and behold, like all highly ambitious and driven basket cases, that's exactly what he ended up doing, is being accepted and attending Harvard. Now, he goes on, there's a lot of chapters early on in this book that I had to skim because they talk a lot about just sort of like the insufferable like culture of Harvard and all their weird like dining clubs and a cappella groups and the kind of, just shit I found unbearable to read and was not even that funny.
It's not like he's wrong that Harvard sucks.
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
Yeah, but reading it, and I also, like Will, sort of glazed over at some of these earlier chapters. Like, they're not poorly written, but they're just not interesting. The substance is not that interesting. But you can tell that he really doesn't think Harvard sucks. You can tell he loves it. I mean, even in retrospect, the way he's writing about it, there's a romantic sort of, like Evelyn Waugh style flavor to the whole thing.
Yeah, he writes early on, "College parties, I later learned, are stinking, sodden affairs in the best of circumstances, thick with sweat and bad cologne and worse beer. The same six songs of the moment blasting from the ceiling and an awful air of heavily made up desperation clinging to the people in attendance. Within a year, I was tired of them, tired of clawing through the crowds in search of warm beer and wretched screwdrivers, tired of gyrating and grinding and generally pretending to have fun, tired of staggering home Saturday night, having searched in vain for a good time." So early on, the Harvard of Ross's dreams does not live up to the Harvard, the reality that he encountered in his freshman year.
Because he's Mark Corrigan.
Yeah, that is the other thing that when Brendan and I were talking about this last night, Ross definitely comes across here, like I said, in his more endearing moments, like the character Mark Corrigan of Peep Show.
"Look at these dropouts. They think they're having fun. If we were agricultural workers, the day would already be half gone."
It's the Ross that has a hard time fitting in or having fun doing the normal things that young people are supposed to have fun doing that I found him at his most sympathetic.
Well, me too, because I totally felt that way in college too. I didn't like those parties, and I bet a few times I probably had one of those dumb, contrived, crotchety old man responses of, "Well, I'll leave you to your gyrating while I this book of Thucydides." But so I definitely feel him a little bit on that.
Right, okay, that's it. Turn the music down. You can stop smoking your drugs. I'm making tea and toast for Sophie. I'm putting on Radio 4. Everything's normal.
But I kind of wonder what the fuck he was expecting at college parties. Do you think because it was Harvard, they were going to be like doing cotillions and shit? Was there going to be somebody playing a piano forte in the corner?
I am reminded of one of my favorite forum posts ever. And I've read over a million posts, so, you know, this is up there. It was someone on the Something Awful forum, and he goes, "Really? Getting laid is the pinnacle? For a few minutes of pleasure and high-fiving your bros versus the experience of a well-crafted RPG where you experience love, loss, and personal triumph? You can keep your getting laid for social validation. I'll take Final Fantasy." And that is what Ross is. Yeah. Ross is that guy.
Despite the fact that a lot of this book is about, I think quite admirably, Ross is very honest in this book about his, like, you know, feeling awkward in social situations and humiliating himself with women. Mm-hmm. Something I can't relate to at all in my college experience. But nonetheless, I found myself sort of feeling Ross in this regard. Mm-hmm. Even though my college experience was, you know, 180 degrees different because I was like, you know, totally cool and never had any problem with the women. So don't let anyone tell you otherwise.
I just also want to say, any girls listening, I am a regular dude.
There is, okay, there's a chapter called, that I skipped entirely, called, fuck, the chapter I skipped entirely was called Approaches to Knowledge. I think he just gripes about grade inflation in that chapter. Mm. There's another chapter called The Strange Career of Suzanne Pommy, in which he relates the story of, as he describes it, a sort of queen bee of the Harvard scene who was a theta and head of the Hasty Pudding theater production. Hasty Pudding is another insufferable Harvard thing where, like, guys cross-dress and invite celebrities to join them in their hilarious pun and word games.
So I went to the Hasty Puddings Club, and it was the gayest goddamn thing I've ever seen to Ehrlichman. I can't shake hands from anybody from Cambridge.
So he writes about this girl, Suzanne, who is his friend's roommate, who is sort of like a, like I said, he describes her as a queen bee, and he says, "I was never attracted to her, though she was attractive to many. She had sex appeal, but there was something off-putting in it, something that was wanton without being worn."
Fuck you.
Oh, my God.
"Her ample bosoms and long, tawny legs attractive, but she lacked a certain wholesomeness in her gaze."
All right, my dear, you may have quote-unquote Mondo jugs, but do you have the heart of values, or are you a decrepit old man on a sailboat?
"Oh, yeah. Shake it, madam. Capital knockers."
Because I like that he uses her real name, by the way. That, like, really sells it. Like, this fucking chick probably has kids right now. And, like, if anyone looks her up now, they just, like,
read about fucking Harvard that Ross Douthat did not want to fuck.
Yeah. "Hey, okay, Ross saw you had sex. No way, lady. No good.
This is my thing, because I would have assumed in a book like this, the legal department of his publishing house would have had to change the names involved in it. But part of me thinks that perhaps they're real.
I think they're all real.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's nonfiction. I don't know. And, like, I feel like in my experience in publishing, like, our legal department would have made us change these names. But I'm so fucking glad they didn't, because Brendan sent me this. As he skimmed through it first, and he sent me the list of names that are in this book are so fucking funny. Here are some of them. Henry Freck. Crawford Larch.
Oh, my God.
Dude, fuck you. Holy no.
Crawford Larch only has one pair of grandparents. That's how inbred Crawford Larch is.
It gets better. Lane Morgan Whittier.
Oh, my God.
Oswald Saperstein.
Oh, fuck you.
And best of all, Barrett, best of all, Eric Swaggart Allenby. We will return to Eric Swaggart Allenby.
Remember that name.
Remember the name of Eric Swaggart Allenby, because he comes back later. But just to return briefly, I you know, to the Suzanne Pommy chapter, I thought was actually sort of the cruelest one, because he talks about, like, this girl who is, like, he uses her as like, you know, indicative of this, as sort of emblematic of this very like high achieving, ambitious, very calculated culture of social advancement and achievement at Harvard. But he like reveals halfway through the chapter that eventually the truth came out, and lo and behold, Suzanne actually came from a quite poor family in Kentucky, and she was spending lavishly at Harvard and doing things like, you know, buying expensive clothes, but also like sponsoring inner city kids in Boston, and just sort of living the ideal Harvard life beyond her means. And then lately, it turns out in the chapter that she was embezzling thousands of dollars from the Hasty Pudding Theater Fund.
Good.
Yeah, dude, she's a fucking class hero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robin Hood, baby.
So this is a big scandal, like his first year at Harvard. And he also makes sure to note that it was Suzanne and her accomplice was her sort of gay best friend, who Ross makes sure to note didn't partake much in the campus life of Harvard because he was doing drugs and going to gay clubs most of the time.
Yeah, that's what he was spending. That's what they do. Yeah. They can't. Yeah, you can't trust those people.
So yeah, there's a whole chapter on the rise and fall of this person, and it's almost like this Great Gatsby story. But I mean, I found Suzanne to be immensely sympathetic, and as you said, almost a heroic figure for fucking stealing all this money from these fucking assholes in the first place.
And I think that we could just note here that this is probably the first flash you get of how Ross, like, yeah, it's relatable. He's not that popular. No one likes him. He wears an ascot, but he's taking his anger out in a way that's nastier and ultimately pretty unbecoming.
And he takes it out on women and gays. What a shock.
Yeah.
You know what he reminds me of? He reminds me of Demonious X, and I will tell you why. Because Demonious X, he will be like, you know, I don't have too many friends. Frankly, I'm fucking depressed. And you're like, oh, man, that sucks, Demonious. And then he'll be like, hey, you know what? Another thing, I'm sick of blacks. And you're like, oh, okay, I get it. Yeah. Like, he makes you feel bad, and then you instantly know why he's in that situation.
So we move on from that to chapter five is when it really gets good.
In a
chapter called Love Stories. And here Ross begins to relate the story of his first college romance and heartbreak. And again, I give Ross credit for being sort of brutally honest about coming to college as a virgin and, you know, vastly less sexually experienced than his peers. Again, something I can't relate to at all.
Me neither.
Yeah, but
I was basically born. I don't even remember when I first got laid. It happened so long ago. By the time I actually got to college, I was sick of having sex.
That's why you would transition to gaming, which is more challenging.
Exactly. Yeah, it's more rewarding.
So he goes on about how he fixates on this girl named Rachel Polly. Again, I fucking hope that's not her real name.
Two of my favorite things.
She was in his dorm. She lived upstairs, and Ross got in his head that, you know, this will be my college girlfriend. And in this chapter, he describes what he calls college marriages. And again, to his credit, I thought he does capture something real about college.
Yeah.
And he critiques these kind of these college like the relationships for people who don't hook up. They just sort of couple up and they have this kind of stable but sort of like low risk relationship for the 4 years of college. And he critiques them actually on sort of almost anti-capitalist grounds. He ventures into this, like he critiques them because they're sort of mercenary and they're kind of about positioning yourself for this sort of social life after college and career advancement. But he critiques them as sort of bloodless. And as he writes, lacking in ardor and conquest, which is his sort of romantic vision. And he fixates his romantic vision on this girl named Rachel. And Rachel begins, you know, hanging out in Ross's dorm. I'm going to paraphrase a lot of this. He discusses it like he sort of gets friend zoned by Rachel. Rachel says to him, quote, Ross, this is weird to say, but I could imagine marrying you, but I don't know if I could date you right now. And to Ross, that's like, that doesn't make sense at all. He's like, let's get married right now. I'm in love with you.
Right.
But eventually he kind of like, you know, breaks, he breaks through a little bit and begins sort of like kissing her shoulders and giving her back rubs in his dorm room. But throughout all of this, Rachel definitely keeps him at an arm's distance.
after a while, they make out a little bit. But lo and behold, Rachel begins hanging out with the sailing team. And captain of the sailing team, none other than our good friend, Eric Swaggart Allenby. So, Ross says, I remember striding across campus the following morning in a brilliant New England spring weather, thinking that if I ever had a son, no, let me be honest, if Rachel and I ever had a son and he wanted advice on women, I would tell him the ticket was persistence and plenty of it. Sure, the whole business had taken me 8 months of effort, but never mind that, I had emerged victorious, hadn't I? That night, for the first time in what seemed months, Rachel didn't come downstairs to my room. She didn't appear the next night, nor the night after. I asked her roommates, oh so casually, if they had seen her. They had, but only briefly, sweeping through in the early evening to gather books and sailing stuff. Then Savina, who lived upstairs and dated my roommate Julian, said that she had passed Rachel in the yard walking with Eric Allenby and a whole gang of sailors on their way down to the river.
Holy shit.
So I did what any technologically savvy, slightly mad college student would do. I fingered Rachel. Now, that sounds worse. That sounds worse than it actually is. My eyes lit up when I read that passage, but you are gonna be disappointed because, quote, fingering was a suggestively named quirk of our email system, a frequently used stalking technique that allowed any user who knew Rachel's email address to discover by typing fingerrpolly@fas.harvard.edu into the command prompt. You could find out where she had last checked her email. By early morning, my computer screen looked something like this. Now, I'm not going to read all this, but just imagine Mr. Robot right now. And it's like his screen, he's looking at his computer screen, and what he found out is that every time Rachel Polly had logged into her email server over like five times in the last week was all from Eric Allenby's room.
Oh, shit!
This is like in the Matrix when Neo asks Cypher if he can see the ones and zeros.
Yeah.
And Cypher's like, yeah, that's a girl in a red dress, in a black dress.
Yeah.
Except with Ross, he's like, I'm getting cocked.
So Ross has sort of a painful confrontation with Rachel about this. And and eventually it comes out that Rachel and Swaggart Allenby are going on a sailing trip together.
It's only come back to the sailboat.
This explains so much of his pathology.
This is the primal scene for Ross. Rachel says, I did warn you not to get too attached, didn't I, Ross? Besides, when you think about it, would it have really worked out? I mean, be honest for a minute. Imagine two of us being together. I'd be off sailing all the time, and you wouldn't really be happy, would you? Dating me and always have to saying, she's off sailing, would you? Why wouldn't I? What possible difference would that make? No, she went on, seeming not to hear. If I date anyone seriously, it should probably be someone on the sailing team.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't want to laugh at this because, honestly, this is Ross at his most human.
Yeah.
She says, you know, she said, musing aloud, maybe you should have gotten me drunk earlier, like back before spring break. Maybe things would have been different. Don't tell me that. Oh, my God. Well, maybe it's true. Are you going to have sex with him? With Eric? On the trip to Florida. Ross, I really don't want to talk about this. So I went on and became ever more maudlin, tearful, and more pathetic. Again, I'm laughing, but like honestly, like I sympathize with Ross. Like I don't want to laugh at this, even though in no way I can relate to this whatsoever. I've never had an experience like this, but I feel for Ross. He says, it ended there, except for my getting drunk on a bottle of cheap wine that night and hurling things around our common room, much to our roommate's dismay. Yes, it ended there. I don't think I ever had a real conversation with Rachel Polly after that long, tear-stained night. There were emails, of course, and some drunken, pathetic, some approximate the dignity that I had barely failed to preserve. But our friendship, such as it was, ended that spring. And the time the Harvidian bustled went off to work, healing the wound and slowly transforming my memory of La Faire Rachel into what it really was, a freshman farce, not a Greek tragedy.
Okay. Look, this is Ross that is most vulnerable, and I want to respond with vulnerability in my heart. When I was a sophomore in high school, this girl that I wanted to go to prom with, and I was like too pussy to ask her. I was in modern European history, and my friend told me that this girl was going to prom with another guy that I knew. And I had a highlighter in my mouth. I had the cap of a highlighter in my mouth because I was taking out to highlight something in my textbook. And I fucking bit down and snapped the highlighter and cracked one of my teeth because I experienced what Ross did. What I did not do was, after that, create a holistic vision of the world where I'm like, what happened to me is because of what society is doing to values. And women, and everyone is wrong but me.
I think the interesting thing about that story is I love that sailing is such a primal thing for Ross, and I can see why he comes back to sailing at the end of this book.
He will be a Scientologist by the end of his life.
Oh, absolutely.
Hella. Okay, so the next chapter is called Safe Sex.
And this is the best one.
This is another good one, because Ross relates a story that is actually very funny.
Yeah.
It begins with his friend Margaret, who goes to Smith, the all-girl, the sort of like the ladies' Ivy, Lady Ivies. And she's begging Ross to come visit her at Smith and, quote, bring boys with you. I miss boys. Everyone here is either a lesbian or pretending to be one. So he's got like this good hookup. If he's looking to smash, I mean, go to an all girls college. This is like Animal House. Like, him and his friends take like a Animal House style road trip to the all girls college to visit his friend Margaret. They're supposed to go out to all these parties, but unfortunately, like, they get there and everyone went to parties the previous night. And this is what they end up doing. Back in the room, Margaret was writing emails, having exchanged her sweatpants for pajamas. Hot. Let's have white Russians, she said encouragingly when we flopped downcast on her rug. But there was no Kahlua, so we drank screwdrivers. And when the orange juice ran out, we made gin and tonics, except there was no tonic, so there were gin and sprites instead. Then we decided to watch a movie, but all Margaret had was Shakespeare in Love. So we watched late night TV, and then a slew of dating shows, and then the infomercials came on, and we knew it was time for bed. Are you guys having fun? Margaret asked me when Tom had vanished to the bathroom. Does it look like we're having fun? Anyway, she flounced. It's not like you fulfilled your end of the bargain. I was promised nice boys to hook up with, Ross. I brought you Tom, didn't I? She sighed. Dear heart, Tom's not my type at all. So she said, he continues. When he came back, we had a nightcap and lay talking in the dark, Margaret in her bed, Tom and I on the floor alongside. Well past midnight, I turned away and announced I was going to sleep, but they went on whispering for a long time while I tried and failed to drift off. At last, there was a silence in the room, and I thought, finally, and rolled over just in time to see Tom sliding into Margaret's bed. His shadow gathered up in her quilted darkness, and then noises began, and I realized that no, this was rock bottom. Again, this is so peep show right
now. So Mark Cuban.
This is so peep show. But I have to continue. Withhold comments. I crawled with my sleeping bag to a far corner of the room, which meant that I was 5 feet away, not two, from Margaret's overburdened twin bed. I huddled there while the minutes passed with agonized slowness, while the murmurs and sighs and damp, kissy squelches merged with the squeal of the bed springs. And when I thought they had to be nearly done, there was a strange thwack. And then another, and then still a third, like the sound of a high five or a slapped face. Or maybe, I thought with mounting horror, a spanking.
This is like if H.P. Lovecraft tried to write a sex scene.
You know what this is like? This is like Ross was Gomer Pyle in Full Metal Jacket, but for Harvard. He was sexual Gomer Pyle. This is if this is Full Metal Jacket for Harvard, this is the blanket party scene.
Ross just in the sleeping bag going, ow!
Oh, mommy!
Sorry, it continues. This actually gets even more Full Metal Jacket. I'm glad you brought this up. after the spanking, after the horror, the Dunwich spanking horror, he said,
oh my God.
He says, I fled then, abandoning my sleeping bag and stumbling out into the hallway, where I blinked in the sudden blaze of fluorescence. I wasn't sure what to do next. The corridor was a row of locked bedrooms, and an all-female college's common room was probably the lousy place for a man in his underwear to hang out. But just standing there in the hall seemed worst of all. So I made for the bathroom, where I stood for a long time staring in the mirror, trying to recognize myself in the wild-eyed insomniac glaring back at me.
What the fuck are you doing, Private Dude Hat?
If the hall RA wakes up, we're going to be in a world of shit. I am in a world of shit, Tom.
Every girl's on the pill, Tom.
But he says, in trying to decide how angry I could be at Tom come the morning. Not very angry at all, came the unwelcome answer. After all, wasn't this why we were at Smith? Why we had traveled all this way to get drunk and crawl into bed with girls we didn't know? See, again, this is like a flash of humanity from Ross here, yeah. Which makes me kind of like him. So he goes into the bathroom to hang out, and then he hears there was a padding of slippers in the hallway then, and girlish voices. I froze for a moment, then dove for the nearest stall, where I crouched on the toilet seat and listened with... and listened to the noise of running water and the scratch of toothbrushes, the soft sounds of gossip. You know, I thought there was someone in here earlier, one of them said, while the other girl spit and gargled. I carefully lifted my feet above the stall door out of sight. It's like a horror movie. It's great.
Oh, no, I think it's more like an espionage thriller.
Yeah.
But this is James Bond, incel James Bond. And this is like the exhilarating scene where he has to hide his sexual shame in the bathroom. This is called From Cambridge, No Love.
No, it gets better. She says, you know, I thought there was someone earlier here in here. I carefully lifted my feet above the stall door. I think it was a boy, came this conspiratorial reply. A boy? I wonder where he went. It was more than I could bear. I'm still here, I bellowed from the stall, and they squealed and fled. So that, to me, is like a genuinely... funny scene. No, that is like
Kingsley Amis or P.G. Wodehouse or whatever.
But like, that's the kind of thing, like, if you were friends with someone and they told you that story of something they did in college, you would be doubled over laughing. But like, Ross doesn't have, like, because he's a conservative, he doesn't have an actual sense of humor.
Yeah.
So the way it's presented is not funny.
Yeah.
But it, like, if he could just tweak it about 5-10%, this would be a very funny piece of writing. Because like, he's honest about his embarrassment and kind of like he said, I can't get any lower than this. Like,
there's nothing funny about the degraded morality of America's college students, William.
Well, Matt, as you said, for the rest of the chapter, what he goes on to do is lament exactly that. He goes on to talk about a fake libertine culture at Harvard, where like everything is supposedly allowed, but nobody is actually really hooking, or they're hooking up a lot less than you would think. But like all of this kind of like hookup and, you know, sex positive things, Ross really doesn't like. He has a thing about oral sex a lot. He talks about oral sex a lot.
Yeah.
Let me find this. He talks about
He's like Principal Skinner. Am I so out of touch? No, it's the children who have bad morals.
But he does have a big thing about oral sex. He talks about oral sex a lot and about how it's like the apotheosis of this kind of new sexual climate where you can just, you know, suck someone off or give someone an orgasm with your mouth without any real connection or commitment or possibility of producing a child.
Yeah, it sounds awful.
Here we go.
The bad stuff about sex with none of the good stuff.
Like responsibility.
And here's where Ross loses me after I think like his most human moment, his most relatable and funniest bit of writing. Is that he goes on and on, like, and he talks about how, like, contraception, but, like, the thing about Ross in all of this lamenting, is that he's fundamentally too gun-shy to go all the way and tell you what he really believes, because for as much as he critiques the kind of culture of social climbing and ambition at Harvard, he's very much a part of it, and he's actually quite forward about that. Because he's ambitious, he won't tell you flat out that he thinks contraception should be illegal. He just sort of laments it in this kind of woe is me, you know, this vague kind of slightly humorous but slightly melancholy cant. We talked in the first back in episode 3 about the Chunky Reese Witherspoon incident. This is where the Chunky Reese Witherspoon incident happens. Oh, my own attempts peaked the summer after my grand freshman failure. I wasted fruitless hours at UConn frats and seedy basement parties, making desperate conversation with various young women. Beer slut, my friends called one. Stumpy, they nicknamed another. So, of course, beer slut. We have to ask, is this beer nerd's cousin, and is Ross slandering her?
Worlds are colliding in this book.
Yo, if you fuck with the beer nerd, Ross, I'm gonna catch you coming out of work.
So, and then he goes on to the Chunky Reese Witherspoon anecdote, which, if you are a real deal Chapo head, you will always be familiar with. But if it's new to you, please return to episode 3 for the full explication of the Chunky Reese Witherspoon anecdote.
Please turn the cassette over.
Okay, this is where Ross talks about sex ed. And I want to ask you guys if this was at all similar to what your experience of sex ed was like in high school. So he said, formal sexual education is thick with charts and diagrams, statistics, and gruesomely cautionary photos. This is what chlamydia looks like, my high school biology teacher would tell us, shoving a picture of a cankerous penis in our face. Little of this information sticks. Nobody remembers the exact risk of pregnancy or the timing of the menstrual cycle when they're fumbling in the dark with a naked woman. Nobody thinks back to that Trojan and banana demonstration when it comes time to put on the condom. Sex ed works, if it works at all, because of the underlying message of those classes, which has less to do with clinical details than with economic and social imperatives. Remember what matters, the young elites are told, first by high school teachers, then by college administrators, parents, and even peers. Remember your career, your parents' hopes, your grad school application, your earning potential as a single Ivy League grad in your early to mid-20s. Remember all of this and be careful whom you screw and how. But Ross is he's a big critic of contraception, and he talks about condoms a lot. But the way he talks about condoms is funny. Like, it's a huge chore, or it's really complicated. And look, sometimes putting a condom on can be annoying, but it's not hard. It's not difficult at all.
No, wait. Hold up. This is the first thing I totally agree with Ross is on. Condoms, we're done with it. No condoms. We the raw boys. Raw boys, stand up. Condoms are stupid. I could fuck it. I could slam my dick in a door with a condom on. I wouldn't feel it. Ross, I'm with you. Real soldiers.
No, I thought we established this in Philadelphia that we only use unlubricated rubbers.
Hell yeah, we're the dry boys.
Dry boys. Chapo dry boys.
Okay. Maybe it's like in that Curb episode where Larry accidentally uses like the numbing condom the wrong way round, and Ross just was like, wow, this is horrible. I'm never doing this again.
Okay. Further on, as I promised, he does talk about oral sex.
Good.
And he says, everybody wins. You can have oral sex with a stranger without worrying about morning after pills. You can have it with an acquaintance or friend and tell yourself that it didn't mean much beyond the gratifying of a brief spasm of desire. And what I love about that is when Ross said brief spasm of desire, he should have said coming. But when I thought of brief spasm of desire, of course, I thought about Arnold and pumping iron and just going, I'm having a brief spasm of desire in the gym. I'm having a spasm of desire at home. I'm spasming desire all day. Think how lucky I feel.
Well, this is actually something, because I skimmed the book, too, as we mentioned before. And I'm not clear on what Ross wants. You know, he's against too much sex. At other times, he's complaining people aren't having enough sex in the right way. And it actually reminds me of a David Foster Wallace essay. I hate David Foster Wallace, but I did read an essay of his that was about how condoms and safe sex and the sexual revolution has produced, you know, a dead hellscape of romance and blah, blah, blah. A lot of what Ross is saying, and that he was complaining that, like, humanity needs a new dragon to slay, and that how, like, you know, this is terrible because there's no risk anymore, and it's all just banal, and sex should be, you know, this, like, very, very risky adventure. And
conquest and ardor, exactly. As Ross says. But no, Brendan, we talked about this yesterday, and this goes back to my original point about Corey Robin and how you have to understand the right wing in a certain way. You can't take it at face value that they're about tradition and, mm-hmm. and preserving hierarchy. They're more radical than that. Mm-hmm. And Ross's attitude about sex here is like, he's like, the sex at Harvard is terrible, and nobody's having enough of it, basically.
Right, right.
And this reminded me of the big clickbaity article that came out this week about like some study showing that millennials are having less sex than ever.
Yeah.
And in the reaction to that article just this week, the people that were most angry about it and most being like, these goddamn kids, were conservatives.
Yeah.
And like, again, on the surface level, it's like, well, what are you mad about? This is exactly what you should want. Kids are being less promiscuous. But for conservatives, it's like they're doing what we want, but for the wrong reasons. Or they're not having as much sex as they used to, but they're not having sex in the wrong way. So yeah, I think you have to understand Ross's complaints about sex and the ruling class through that lens. Okay, now this brings us to sort of the end of the book. And here is where Ross loses me. Mm-hmm. I've been building up, like, I actually sympathize with them, and I sort of felt a humanity in him that I hadn't before reading this book, but he fucking blows it all at the end of the book, becoming another fucking reptile again. When we discuss in the chapter The Days After, which, wouldn't you know it, is about 9/11, when 9/11 happened.
Ooh.
And of course, Ross, as he says, was, you know, horrified by this, but he cannot help but betray how fucking excited he is by all of this.
Yeah.
And he says, He narrates, you know, watching 9/11 happen, and oh, the horror. And like every idiot in America in the days after 9/11, he immediately thought that, like, you know, terrorist attacks are going to happen everywhere all the time.
Yeah.
So I just want to read here. He says, I expected car bombs or maybe even suicide bombers. I pictured an explosion every time I walked through Harvard Square, imagining the newsstand shattered, the street musicians and goth kids ripped apart, the red brick stained redder, a scream of sirens amid the smoke and broken glass and shredded newsprint. And what I love about this is, like, Ross is so disappointed that it actually didn't happen.
Well, some of these guys actually, I mean, were open about it. Like, I think Christopher Hitchens, though he was making a transition nominally from the left.
He basically said he had a yard long. Long fucking hard on 9/11.
He had a war chubby, and what he said, I think, almost verbatim, was, it exhilarated me. And Ross doesn't quite go that far.
Actually, to be fair, Ross actually does say that.
Oh,
I tagged it, but he does say that he felt a sense of exhilaration.
Yeah, that's
and
healthy.
And he says why. He says, you know, our nation, this generation, will lift, you know, the dark threat of violence in our people for the future.
Yeah.
And like, you know, Ross is a conservative. He, like, and like most conservatives, he felt like this is really our moment.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes on to, for insulting me personally, he goes on to shit on Gore Vidal and calls him a decaying monument, which I think is funny because in the previous chapter...
Hey, hold on a minute. Gore Vidal had just as much coiled potency as the fucking rotted corpse of William F. Buckley, whose dick you stared at.
More so.
Like I said, you don't have to like Gore Vidal. I took offense to this, but more so because in the previous chapter, he literally describes sucking plaster dust out of William Buckley's dick. This is really good. He says, in the same... This is classic Duthat right here. He says, in the same month, the first Lord of the Rings movie was released.
Yeah.
And I dragged Alice, this is another girl he's trying to get with, to it, despite her avowed dislike of fantasy, there in the darkened theater, wondering if she would like the movie. She would. Wondering if I would ever muster the nerve to tell her I loved her. I would, but not until spring, after she had broken up with her boyfriend. And then in the movie theater, months after 9/11, I heard Kate Blanchett's Galadriel breathe the movie's opening line. The world has changed, she said. I feel it in the water. I feel it in the earth. I smell it in the air. The world has changed. So, you know, 9/11, just like Lord of the Rings, like all conservatives really believe.
I do think that no one who has read the Silmarillion should be allowed to comment on politics or run for public office.
So yeah, he goes on about, he laments the fact that the ROTC wasn't on campus, and talks about like this new sense of, you know, purpose and meaning in the world. But of course, he says, no one at Harvard, myself included, actually enlisted because it would, you know, he frames it as it would, you know, fuck up our career plans. But at no point does he actually mention the fear of actually dying in one of these wars. So there's a lot of sacrifices to be made, but mostly by other people. Yeah. And this is where Ross loses me entirely by being an absolute cunt after, of course.
Well, I mean, that is the perfect playbook. These guys get exhilarated by the idea of civilizational conflict because they know that they will be able to enjoy all of the bloodshed vicariously. They know that they'll never have to worry about being personally endangered by it, that it can be totally a game to them. It can be totally like erotic thrill. So of course they get fucking psyched.
Actually, but before I get to the very end of this story, I want to do a brief digression. This is an anecdote I told Brendan about my college experience, which the first week of my freshman year was when 9/11 happened. And being a lifelong New Yorker, it was a surreal experience for me. It, like, you know, like everyone, it was terrifying at the time. But in the back of my mind, you know, I knew there was no reason for my, you know, family or anyone I knew to have been in the Twin Towers. But it was a genuinely, you know, frightening moment. But that very night... Like I said, in my first week of college, I got busted by campus security for smoking weed in my dorm room.
That's the real.
And as a result of it was,
yeah, it is.
And the result of that was I was made to go before some sort of star chamber of campus administration and their kind of Vichy student collaborators. And during this actual meeting, this is my asshole moment in college. They were like, "Do you have anything to say for yourself?" And I literally was like, "Well, I'm from New York City, and my whole family is from New York City."
Yes.
Well,
9/11 did happen.
Hell yeah.
I was like, well, the date was sort of significant. And, you know, I think it should be taken into account, my, you know, very minor transgression in the large scheme of things. And one of the guys who was like the sort of upperclassman on this little discipline board got really angry and was like, almost did an actual, "How dare you, sir?" He was like, "I don't think it has anything to do with this. And I'm shocked that you would even bring it up." And I was like, well, I had to give it a try.
Yeah, I took a risk.
I have a funny 9/11 story. My brother went to Vassar in upstate New York, and like the day of 9/11, he like called our house and was like, "I'm okay." And my dad went, "Yeah, no shit. You're in fucking Poughkeepsie. Why wouldn't you be?"
The thing I like about Will's story, it reminds me. You remember in The Loop when
oh right
yeah
when the gangly guy, he has sex, he cheats
on his girlfriend,
his girlfriend, and he and then he gets caught and he's under the spotlight with like in public, and he goes, "You know, maybe in a way it was just I was just trying to stop this bloody war." And that's what Will was telling the kid. I also went to Skidmore, so I know.
Oh, by the way, yeah, for listening to this show, Brendan and I attended the same college, Skidmore. Yeah. Thoroughbreds represent, baby.
Absolutely. Fucking woo. Thoroughbred to the very end. Woo. Yeah.
Skidmore, baby. Alumni. By the way, if you are a Skidmore college student listening to this and would like to arrange to have a podcast celebrity come and speak on campus, two podcast celebrities who are famous alumna of the school.
Indeed.
All it will take is a couple $1,000s and free room and board in the finest hotels in Saratoga for us to do that. So, and by the way, if Don Hastings is there, please tell him I say hi.
Same.
And, if anyone from my alma mater, Gulen University Online, is listening,
I was at my job the other day, and I met a journalist who is Turkish, and she was genuinely like gobsmacked at how much I knew about Turkey, and asked where I learned all this, and I didn't tell her.
It was too embarrassing. Yeah, okay, to close it out, we're wrapping it up with Ross here. I just want to read from the very last paragraph of Privilege, the Ross Douthat story. He says, "I hope, in the end, that I love Harvard as we should love the world, not because it is good, it is not, but because there is good in it and things worth fighting for." That may ring familiar to you if you've seen a little film called Seven, starring Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman.
Almost verbatim what Morgan Freeman says.
This is almost verbatim the very end of Seven. Ross Douthat paraphrases for the end of his book.
He says, that was a Hemingway quote in the first place. So double plagiarism. Right. Well done, buddy.
Morgan Freeman quotes Ernest Hemingway and then adds his own bit, which Ross also takes.
Ernest Hemingway once wrote, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." I agree with the second part.
But he continues after that bit of very clever, nobody noticed that, Ross, it's okay.
Condoms are in the box, by the way. He's asking what's in the box?
What's in the box?
He's on the pill.
Yeah. Ross, perhaps the rest will pass away. Until in my memory and the memory of my classmates, only the best remains. The beauty of the place and the promise of greatness. A promise that went unfulfilled in my 4 years, but endures nonetheless, as if around another corner, through another ivied gate, there waits the university of our imagination, the Harvard of our unrequited dreams. And that's beautiful. And what I love about that, thinking back on the college experience of Ross, and definitely not my own, the college of our dreams is an unrequited one. Somewhere out there in the fantasy world, in the Elysium Fields, there was a college where we all fucked and had a great time.
Amen, brother.
To quote Littlefinger from Game of Thrones, in a better world, I would have been the one fucking in a sleeping bag at Wellesley. But we don't live in that world.
Ours is a fallen one. And hence, that is the nature of, I think, the conservative philosophy. I think, actually, and I mean this genuinely, actually, I think this book, Privilege, does do a good job of representing the conservative worldview.
Yeah.
In a kind of succinct way. And you know, really, Ross is actually not a bad writer.
He's not.
He's a bad person, but it's an interesting read, especially if you can't relate to any of the humiliations within it, like myself.
Every part where he's like, I was surprised by, couldn't relate. I've never been surprised by anything.
Yeah.
I've never been denied sex. I've never even sought it out. It just like has happened to me. It seems like happened to me where like I go places and girls are like, I want you to fertilize me. And I'm like,
It sounds like Ross.
I'm just over it.
Ross could have a good shot at being a Grey Wolf co-host with his non-sexual track record.
Ross, come on the show. Yeah, you're now a fixed constellation in the Chapo universe. Ross Gregory Douthat, everybody. That concludes this, our most epic Chapo reading series ever. Privilege. Harvard and the Education of the Ruling Class. I put it to bed now, and I leave it to you, our listeners, to absorb the message and apply the lessons in your own life. Till next week, guys.
I'm off to see Suicide Squad right now.
Hell yeah.
Hell yes.
Hell
By the way, next week's show, the Suicide Squad is happening.
Oh, yeah,
baby. We're all going to commit suicide together. A little bit of homework for next week's show. Everybody read Felix's review of Suicide Squad at Deadspin to prepare yourself for the soul-destroying madness that is Suicide Squad. And we're definitely having Matt Brady on to talk about it as
well. Hell yeah.
Matt Brady is making his triumphant return on the Suicide Squad episode and next week. Till then, guys.
Hell yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Always a pleasure.
Bye. Deus in eternum. Don't have sex.
Bye.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere we...
Right shoulder!
My lover stands...
Lock and load! Order! This is my rifle! There are many like it, but this one is mine! Get back in your bunks! Put in this Mickey Mouse shit! Put in the name of Jesus Christ, are you animals doing in my head? Why is Private Pyle out of his bunk after lights out? Why is Private Pyle holding that weapon? Why aren't you stomping Private Pyle's guts out?
Sir, it is the private's duty to inform the senior drill instructor that Private Pyle has a full magazine. and is locked and loaded, sir!
Now you listen to me, Private Pyle, and you listen good. I want that weapon, and I want it now. You will place that rifle on the deck at your feet and step back away from it. What is your major malfunction, numbnuts? Didn't Mommy and Daddy show you enough attention when you were a child?